Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. In this hour, who owns you? Who has to pay you? Your secrets, your cell phone calls, your genes, folks. The government spies on its own citizens, but does it own the information? More fallout from that this hour. Congress also arguing over how the military should treat cases of sexual assault. And it may be payday for interns, folks. Working class hero, thy name is intern. To all you unpaid interns out there, it's time to bow down to your new heroes, Alexander Footman and Eric Glatt. Footman and Glatt won a case in court that may force employers to pay interns for any real work they do, along with paid employees. Got an internship lined up for the summer? Keep track of anything you do that's the same as paid employees, and the court says you might have a paycheck coming. We'd love your stories anyhow. Ever do any work as an intern you thought you should be paid for? We'd love to hear your stories. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to thetakeaway.org. One more thing.
You're actually standing on top of the world with your own 2 feet. So it was overwhelmingly unbelievable for me. I was just standing there looking at my feet, literally pinching myself. It was incredible.
A view from the summit of Mount Everest from a woman who peers out from behind a traditional veil on the streets of her own country, 25-year-old Raha Muharrak, the first Saudi woman and the youngest Arab ever to make it to the top of the world. But first, the Supreme Court unanimously ruled today that naturally occurring human genes cannot be patented. All 9 justices agreed that while naturally occurring DNA cannot be patented, synthetic DNA can. The case at hand involves Myriad Genetics, a company that patented the BCRA1 and BCRA2 genes, genes that indicate a significantly increased risk for breast and ovarian cancer. The court's decision is considered a significant victory for cancer patients whose medication, testing, and treatment costs might go down as a result of this decision. Joining us is experienced biotech patent attorney Robert Blackburn, former vice president and chief patent counsel of Chiron Corporation. He's also a former distinguished scholar at the Berkeley Center for Law and Technology and has taught at the UC Berkeley Law School. Robert Blackburn, welcome to the program.
Thanks, John. Glad to be here.
So how much has the Supreme Court changed the landscape? Your entire career has been spent in a situation where the presumption was a lot of this was going to be patentable.
Well, I think this is a pretty modest change. The reality is that most of the practical applications of this type of technology is done with synthetic DNA sequences, not the naturally occurring ones. So I think this is actually a big relief for industry, this decision.
And in the sense that the Supreme Court is often impatient with Congress, thinking that it's Congress's duty to change the law, is there any sort of indication in here that they would love to see Congress clarifying this? This isn't really a constitutional question. This is an interpretation of current patent law, right?
Right. It's an interpretation of the subject matter part of the statute on patents. There are several tests for patentability. One is subject matter. The other is whether it's obvious, whether it's novel, and whether the patent claims the invention too broadly, broader than the inventor actually enabled. So the subject matter basis is a pretty big sledgehammer to use, but they used it fairly precisely here, fairly narrowly, to just take the natural genes out of the picture, which is, I think, a result that the industry can live with.
Now, let's talk about the Myriad issue for a moment. They patented the BCRA1 and the BCRA2 genes. The Clarence Thomas decision, the opinion written by Justice Clarence Thomas, I believe, suggests that finding a gene and isolating it does not constitute invention. How does the industry look at that?
Well, you know, I think if we remember that there's these other requirements, a lot of people thought that just standard routine work that finds new genes wouldn't be patentable in today's world, not because of this subject matter issue, but because it's obvious how to do it. So, in that sense, the result is still what what I think fits a lot of people's expectations here. So, I think it's really helpful if we think that about patent law as being really industrial policy, and what you want to do is encourage people to invest in research. And you do that by letting them get a payback via a patent on it. So the real question is does this inhibit companies from investing in research, which is actually what's going to help cancer patients in the long run? And I don't think this will discourage investment.
So the people who do real work in synthesizing genes, developing real therapies, they're probably not going to have any problem with this whatsoever. It's just the relatively few cases of patentable naturally occurring genes that are going to have a problem with this? And is it retroactive at all, do you know?
Yes, this would apply to all patents as they exist today, whether they were granted before the decision or currently pending. So, I actually think there are very few patents, and it won't be on a patent-by-patent basis. The patents are defined by claims at the end, and they're usually multiple claims. So Myriad, for example, had claims to the synthetic DNA, and those were found fine. And in fact, the testing technology uses small segments of synthetic DNA. So I'm not even sure Myriad is going to suffer from this decision at all.
Finally, is there any sort of downstream conundrum here that this is a decision raises in the sense that, okay, maybe something is synthetic today, but, 500 generations from now, it's suddenly naturally occurring again in some organism, agriculturally or in medicine, and that suddenly we got to revisit all this?
Well, that's certainly possible. As the technology evolves, the law has to evolve to keep up with it. And that's kind of an interesting aspect of this decision is the concurrence by Judge Scalia. I don't know if you read it. I mean, this guy, no matter how you feel about his politics, he's a smart guy. And he wrote a concurrence. I've never seen anything like it. He basically says, I agree with the result here, but I really don't understand the science.
And Scalia's nothing if not honest, that's for sure. Robert Blackburn, thanks so much.
Okay.
Experienced biotech attorney, a biotech patent attorney, Robert Blackburn is a former vice president and chief patent counsel of Chiron Corporation, also former distinguished scholar at the Berkeley Center for Law and Technology, who has taught at UC Berkeley Law School. The decision, 9-0, the Supreme Court says naturally occurring genes cannot be patented. There's a legal battle on Capitol Hill over how the military treats sexual assault cases. The persistence of the problem has produced huge problems for morale among uniformed personnel in all of the armed forces.
The real challenge is that men and women who are attacked don't feel that they can tell their commanding officer.
That's Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, Democrat of New York, who wants special prosecutors to deal with these crimes out of the traditional chain of command. Within the chain of command, a recent Pentagon report says 62% of sexual assault victims believe they faced some kind of retaliation after coming forward. But Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel says an outside accountability for sexual assault cases will be disruptive and not work.
I don't think you can fix the problem or have accountability within the structure of the military without the command involved in that.
The compromise this week in the Senate Armed Services Committee would not require a special prosecutor, but it would trigger an automatic review of cases when a commander overrules a military lawyer's advice to prosecute sex assault cases. It's also believed that the Senate will include a measure to end the practice of military commanders having the power to nullify verdicts in sexual assault cases that do go to court. Attorney Susan Burke joins us now. Burke represents military personnel who've been sexually assaulted. First of all, Susan, welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
What do you make of this debate over the chain of command versus outside of the chain of command? It seems a little suspiciously like what the Catholic Church was arguing before that went away very, very quickly on the sexual assault cases in the church.
John, that's correct. We have a lot of resistance from the military to giving the service members a fair and impartial system of justice. Rather, they want to keep it completely controlled within the chain of command, which unfortunately, in many instances, leads to these things being covered up and swept under the rug.
What would a special prosecutor be able to do that the normal chain of command can't?
Well, it's more than a special prosecutor. What Senator Gillibrand and the other eight senators voted for was a fair and impartial judicial system that said, okay, we need to have crimes, serious crimes, not just rape and sexual assault, but all serious crimes, adjudicated in a manner that does not let the chain of command intervene in judicial matters. And so it set up, it did not take it into civilian courts, but rather it set up a parallel system that was akin to a civilian system in which you have independent prosecutors making prosecutorial decisions on which crimes should be brought to court and which should not.
Susan, if I'm on base at Fort Hood and I decide to rob a bank down the street, does the local police get to arrest me and local courts get to decide if I'm a robber?
Well, what we have in this nation is dual jurisdiction, where service members, the military often attempts to exercise jurisdiction over service members' crimes, even if they happen outside of military space. And there is dual jurisdiction. So what we've been doing, in light of the fact that Senator Gillibrand's legislation did not prevail, we've been encouraging all service members who are raped or assaulted to go to civilian authorities who also have jurisdiction over these crimes.
So there is potentially civilian jurisdiction if the victim goes outside of the chain of command, but there could be punishment for that. The military is in a position to be punitive over people who take matters into their own hands.
Well, and I'll give you one very high profile example. General Amos, one of his aides was raped. General Amos decided it should not be prosecuted. The investigator who worked on the case was so appalled by that decision that he slipped a file to his civilian counterpart. The civilians were able to get a plea bargain from the rapist, and he did serious time in jail. So, you know, if people need to have the courage to come forward and stop these serial predators, but they're well advised to do it in the civilian courts because the military courts just have proven to be ineffective.
It's expected that Gillibrand's special prosecutor measure will be reintroduced in the Senate before the end of the summer. And Senator McCaskill from Missouri, her amendment on getting the commander nullification provision removed is also likely to come up. Any of those things give you some sort of comfort here?
Well, we'll continue fighting on behalf of the rape survivors, rape and sexual assault survivors, until there's a fair and impartial system of justice. Our view is that the patriots who are willing to put their lives on the line to defend us shouldn't be relegated to a second-class system of justice.
Attorney Susan Burke represents military personnel who've been sexually assaulted. We'd love to know if you have any insights into this matter. Susan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. Later this hour, we're talking about unpaid internships. Have you ever had one? Was it worth it? And should interns always be paid, or is the experience enough? Johnny wrote this on our Facebook page. The biggest problem with internships is for those of us returning to school. I still have all my regular bills, but now I have to do an internship stint, hopefully around my regular full-time job, and I hope I can find one that pays. Not only that, I have to pay tuition to do it. I think there is value in doing the internship, don't get me wrong, but it shouldn't bankrupt you in the process. Tell us about your intern days. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. More on new legal questions with unpaid internships next. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill finally got to ask some questions of the intelligence chief behind those leaked and secret surveillance programs that look at internet and cell phone data.
Here I have my Verizon phone, my cell phone. What authorized investigation gave you the grounds for acquiring my cell phone data?
That's Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley posing one among many questions yesterday put to NSA Director Keith Alexander, who testified for the first time before the Senate Appropriations Committee, since the agency's newly leaked top secret surveillance programs became known. Alexander had been previously scheduled to testify about federal spending on cybersecurity, and there was plenty of discussion of that. But the NSA leaks were the big headline. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick is with us. Welcome, Todd.
Hi, John.
So was this a showdown or more informational there in front of the Senate Appropriations Committee?
Well, it was a little bit of both. The problem, it wasn't so informational. You heard Jeff Merkley's question there. Is it Keith Alexander, chief of the NSA, can't answer a lot of these questions? And that's why senators want Alexander and the NSA to declassify a lot more of PRISM and the Section 215, the Verizon data mining program, so that some of these things can be discussed in public.
Well, Alexander did make the essential point that these programs, whatever you think about them, actually do work.
It's dozens of terrorist events that these have helped prevent.
Dozens of terrorist events, he said, but he did elaborate.
Right. When I say dozens, what I'm talking about here is that these authorities complement each other in helping us identify different terrorist actions and help disrupt them.
And what did you make of this, Todd? Was Alexander persuasive?
One of the things that Keith Alexander was trying to do was to say, look, now that these programs are, it was an interesting dichotomy. He said, we're not trying to hide anything about two highly classified programs. Now that these programs are leaked and they're in the public, we're not acting like we're doing anything wrong. We want to discuss it without giving up sources and methods. So we want to brief senators. We want to declassify bigger parts of this program. One of the terror plots they say they foiled is a plot to blow up subway cars in New York. The NSA says now they want to talk about the benefits of these programs so that the American public can balance the benefits with the obvious risks, which is being spied on by their government. Intelligence Chairman Dianne Feinstein was in the hearing, even though it wasn't her committee, and is also telling Alexander that she wants to be able to classify a more detailed list, John, of some of the terror plots that they say have been foiled using these programs. Meanwhile, Jeff Merkley, who you heard from, is already introducing a bill. It's not out yet, but he wants to declassify some of the FISA proceedings, the FISA court that makes rulings, that gives the NSA the legal authority to get some of these data. He says there is no way for the public to actually debate this without understanding the plain language of the way the NSA interprets the Patriot Act. We can all read the Patriot Act, but the interpretation is secret, and the FISA rulings are secret. Merkley wants to put a stop to that.
So the issue here, at least in Merkley's view and some others on the Senate floor there, is a sense of disclosure. But I'm getting the sense that senators are pretty much bought into these programs. Your thoughts?
Many of them are, but not all of them. And one of the issues here, as you know, John, is a lot of these senators say we didn't know about this. Other ones say you better have known about it. Listen to Lindsey Graham here about what senators knew about PRISM and Verizon and when they knew it.
Well, if you didn't know, you got nobody to blame but yourself. Just show some interest and go to the briefings. They sent out a Dear Colleague letter last year, the year before last, saying anybody interested in this program, please come by and get briefed. Go ask them when they sent it. Get Saxby, send a Dear Colleague letter out.
Now, give me some context here. I mean, it's not like the NSA said, hi, we're violating the Fourth Amendment. Come on to this briefing. We'll tell you all about it.
Right. And one senator on the Intelligence Committee who's been on it for many, many, many years said these briefings, really, a senator has to know to take the initiative about what to ask. You can get briefed. Now, they're not going to brief you on a bunch of classified stuff if you're a rank-and-file congressman from wherever. The Intelligence Committee gets that. But you have to know to ask, which is difficult. If you did know to ask, senators were able to be briefed on the broad outlines of these programs, not the details.
I was surprised. We'll play you one last clip here that a normal very high-profile Republican, Bob Corker, Republican of Tennessee, knew nothing. Listen.
I was very aware of the second program that was leaked. I was unaware of the first program.
The administration kind of needs Corker on their side on this one.
They do. Now, lucky for them, Corker said once he was briefed on the Section 215 data mining, the Verizon story, that he was completely comfortable with it. Corker also says that oversight of these programs are going to get a lot more attention. He's not interested in shutting them down. He, like a lot of other senators and members of Congress, are interested in a lot closer oversight of how they're debated and how they're overseen in Congress, John.
Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Thanks so much, Todd.
Pleasure.
Later this hour, we're going to talk about the value of unpaid internships. Have you ever had one? Is it fair not to be paid in exchange for the work or the experience?
I'm a legal intern right now, and I don't want interns to have to be paid because that's going to make it that much harder to find a job. And it's really already very hard to find a legal job.
Some gratitude now from Shrewsbury, Massachusetts. Unpaid internships have helped me gain skills necessary to be competitive. My unpaid experience will hopefully pay off in a good job. From Commerce, Michigan, though, in medical school, what we called an internship, we got paid for. If you're not getting paid, I call that volunteering. And here's the flip side of that.
My name is Jay Berger, calling from Shelby Township, Michigan. I have a small leather shop. I recently hired somebody. They didn't have the skill set that I anticipated, but I'm training that person, and it ends up becoming more of an internship. I am paying this person, but it wasn't my intent for them to progress along so slowly.
A little more positive from this listener in Miami, Florida. Internships are a good way to see if a candidate would fit as a potential employee. This person writes, you can teach anyone how to do the task. What you can't teach is motivation, dedication, and commitment. You have those traits or you don't. Unpaid internships are a good way to see if your potential new employee has those traits. I call that an audition, though, Miami. If they have the traits, then they are well underway of getting a foot in the door. If they don't have the traits, then they're on their way out the door. Have you had an unpaid internship in your life? We'd love to hear the story. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to weigh in on this conversation. Anything else you hear on the show, this is The Takeaway. Bad economic times make for good students, it looks like. What gets people to sit up and pay attention in class? Knowing that unemployment is the most likely career path out there. That's the conclusion, not exactly a shocker, from some new federal data that show that the number of Americans graduating from college has jumped in recent years, with more students enrolling in school, more actually graduating as well. Joining us now is Claudia Golden, who's professor of economics at Harvard University. Welcome, professor.
Welcome to you, too.
So is this just students sort of scared stiff by the recession, finding a little refuge, or does it constitute something of an upgrade for the workforce going forward?
I think much of it is the latter, because we have seen this increase before the Great Recession, and we have seen it during the Great Recession. It's a little bit of both, but it does look right now like it is that returns to college are just very high. And we are seeing it just about across the board. We're seeing it for white men, definitely white women, definitely Hispanics and African Americans, too.
Now, it's hard to tell from these data, but it would be important that the places that people are going to study, the kinds of skills that they're getting are actually for jobs that are going to be available once they get out. Is there any indication that people's college choices get sharper in the midst of a recession, or do we still have a lot of English majors? Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Not that there's anything wrong with that at all, but it is the case that students are disproportionately going into majors, for example, in the healthcare sector, as well as in other sectors that we have great demand for.
I guess there's some sort of commentary that if people are going back to school only during a recession, it suggests that they aren't completing their education or they aren't taking full advantage of higher education at the times when they should. Would you recommend, or do the statistics show that jumping into the workforce too early is a mistake?
I don't know if jumping into the workforce too early is always a mistake, but it is probably a mistake when the returns to education are so high and when the labor market is demanding often very specific skills and when firms are not providing the training.
What was the impact on American society post-Depression when so many people, for a variety of reasons, stayed in school or went back to school or found school as an option in hard economic times?
Well, in the very hard economic times of the Great Depression, when unemployment rates were double digit and when young people could not find work and when, in fact, laws changed so that very young people were not going to be employed, they went to high school in very large numbers across industrial America, particularly male state and high school enrollment rates and graduation rates soared, class sizes increased by a tremendous amount, and that then led to a group of men who went into World War II, for example, as high school graduates. The high school graduation rate was already high, but in much of industrial America, it wasn't as high as it was later to be during the Great Depression.
And then with the GI Bill after World War II, we really transformed the American workforce.
We transformed certain parts of the American workforce. The college graduation rates and the college going rates were relatively high for a rich country then. We were certainly the leaders then in having our young people go to college, but it certainly increased rates by quite a lot after. In the late 40s and early 50s, there really was a huge increase in college going by young men.
Not the same scale today, but certainly echoes of some of the same social changes that are possible from these statistics. Claudia Golden, thanks so much.
Certainly.
Claudia Golden is a professor of economics at Harvard University.
Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. So how's that unpaid internship going, folks? And we've been asking for some stories. Suzanne wrote us this. All the ones I held eventually led to paying jobs. I'm all in favor of them. If you take advantage of all that one has to offer, the possibilities of landing a job, networking, and an excellent reference can make all the difference during the job hunt. From Everett Washington, though, a slightly contrary view, a waste. I would argue whether or not they are even ethical, I'm sure they are a legal gray area. Legal gray area. Eric Glad?
Yes. Hi, John. I do not think this is a legal gray area. I haven't for years, and I finally got a federal judge to agree with me.
When did you first think you were in something of a gray area there with the Fox Searchlight pictures?
I think I, like a lot of people, thought this was a gray area when I walked into the internship. But in the spring of 2010, the Department of Labor issued a fact sheet, and the New York Times reported on it. And when I read their coverage of the law and started digging into it, I realized it wasn't a gray area. It was already black and white. It was settled back in 1947 in a Supreme Court case.
All right. So we're talking with Eric Glad, the energetic Eric Glad, who's just off winning a court case that, you know, since you are out in Hollywood, you're kind of the Norma Ray of unpaid interns, I suspect, in that this landmark decision suggests that any time an intern is given work that relates to what a paid employee would get, you're eligible for wages. And that's exactly what you sued Fox Searchlight over and exactly what a judge ruled, right?
Exactly. If you're doing productive labor that helps your employer make a profit, why wouldn't that be compensated? That's exactly why we established the minimum wage 75 years ago this month.
Did you try to get a job at Fox Searchlight, but the only thing available was internship?
Well, the way that work in the film industry works, as in journalism and a lot of other areas, is it's usually freelance, where you bounce from job to job to job. So every time you finish a job, you go back on the market to look for another one. And I, like a lot of people working in the film industry, regularly encounter job ads that are for meaningful, productive work with skill sets and experience, but then someone slaps the word intern on it and thinks they can get away with not paying for it.
And part of the issue in court was you didn't receive any kind of training or special sort of seminar with the stars when you were working on the film Black Swan?
Exactly. There wasn't even the attempt to create the appearance of something that was school-like or training-like. It was basically entry-level work replacing entry-level jobs in multiple departments, and it's standard practice in the industry.
And you have an MBA, and you were doing a career switch, and basically they just looked at your MBA, allegedly, because we asked Fox Searchlight for a statement, but we didn't get one, just characterizing that. But they looked at your MBA and put you on auditing work, right?
Well, I was in the accounting department. Yeah, it was. I think that probably related to the fact that I'd also worked in financial services before. I thought it was a department that would be, you know, well served to both the skill set I had and to getting an overview of that function.
Haven't received your check yet, I'm guessing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right.
No, and from what I've seen, they certainly haven't called me, but Fox has signaled to the press that they intend to appeal. So mm-hmm. If that happens, it may be a bit longer.
Now, I suspect this summer, in workplaces, including this one, are going to be scratching their heads going, all right, are we doing this right or are we doing this wrong? That was exactly your intention, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The reason I brought this to federal court was, you know, if I just went to, you know, a smaller court by myself, and even if I prevailed, no one would have heard about it, and the industry practices would have continued without any change. And, you know, I'm doing this because I've looked around, and at this time of, you know, terrible unemployment for young people who have average declining wages for their first job after college, over the course of the last 10 years, average wages right after college have been going down. There's all this competition for each other to get these unpaid positions. The way that this has all been structured is just upside down and backwards. And I think it was important for someone to step forward to change that.
Well, you and your co-plaintiff did, and congratulations.
Although
thank you
very much.
One of the consequences could be that people getting a chance to do, you know, real jobs as opposed to just, you know, the faxing, you know, that's going to change significantly. But we don't have time to talk about that right now. Eric Glad, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Eric Glad is a plaintiff in the Glatt v. Fox Searchlight Pictures case. He worked for several months as an accounting intern on the production of Black Swan and won a lawsuit saying he should have been paid.
Out of the hills.
name of this song is Don't Leave, Don't Leave, a love song from the Middle East, but also perhaps the parting words heard by a Saudi woman who earlier this year left home on an adventure. Don't leave, don't leave, her father might have said. On May 18th, that adventure took young Raham Harik to the summit of Mount Everest, 60 years after the mountain was conquered by Edmund Hillary and his Sherpa guide Tenzing Norgay. But Raham Harik, who is now the youngest Arab as well as the first Saudi woman to reach the summit of Mount Everest, in a country where women's sports are actively dissuaded by government policy, where there are few role models for young female athletes, this was a moment very unlike Hillary's. For Raha, it was not a mountain she conquered, but perhaps something bigger, higher perhaps than Everest's 29,029 feet.
On the summit, to be honest, I imagined this moment. I dreamed about this moment. And, you know, you see clips and movies and then documentaries, and then you're actually standing on top of the world with your own two feet. So it was overwhelmingly unbelievable for me. I was just standing there looking at my feet, literally pinching myself. And it took our head guide, him screaming at me. He's like, Raha, you're here. You've made it. You are here, for me to be like, oh my God, I'm standing on top of the world. It was incredible.
What do you think accounts for the hesitation, the inability to just be in the moment until you're really reminded of what you've done?
I think because it was built up to be something so unattainable for a woman like me. So when the moment actually came, it was too good to be true. You know what I mean? In that moment, because I was told this is insane and you shouldn't do this and you can't do this. So for me actually to be there, I was like, wow, did I really pull this off? It was very humbling, though. I was not able to grasp me standing up there. And then seeing the curve of the earth, and we could see for miles. It was a beautiful day. You know, we were, besides the really horrid winds, it was a beautiful day. So hard to explain.
You know, when they asked Sir Edmund Hillary why he climbed Mount Everest, you know, his answer was this famous, and maybe it's even apocryphal, because it was there, you know, which is very easy to imagine that a Westerner like Hillary, you know, is out conquering this, that, and the other thing, and gets around to Everest eventually, the North Pole, South Pole, all the sorts of things that Westerners conquered. Is there a message in the fact that Muslims, Arabs, Arab women in your case, came late to the mountain? And what do they make of this kind of conqueror ethos of the earlier days?
I think we came late. Not just because there are a lot of, you know, culture and religious restrictions. It's not that. I do come from a very traditional family. I think what Arab women lacked was, yes, we have dreams, we have aspirations, but what we lacked is the courage to go for them. And when I mean courage, I don't mean actually physically standing on, not being afraid of standing on the mountain. What I mean is having the courage to sit down with your parents and say, Dad, Mom, this is my dream. Support me. Help me live my dream. A lot of women hesitate in fear of rejection and in fear of insulting the family. You know what I mean? It's not just I need to have the courage to walk in crevasses and go up the Kumba Icefall. No, I have to have the courage to confront them and have the conviction to convince them. I mean, it was very difficult for them to let me go for 2 months. Not anyone, not any father in general, and specifically in the Arab world, would be okay with that. I think that's why we were a bit late.
So did you conquer that, or did you conquer the mountain?
I don't think that any mountain, especially Everest, is something you conquer. I believe you train, you do your best, you pray for good weather, and you hope that the mountain gives you a shot and looks the other way as you sneak up to the summit and come back down. You can't conquer Everest. I don't think so.
Were you lucky then?
Extremely lucky. I went up and down in fantastic time with 10 fingers, 10 toes, no burns in my face. So I am extremely lucky to have it that way. It's really amazing.
Well, more than just luck, certainly. You know, it was just the month of Rajab, which is the month when Muhammad ascended into the heavens.
Yeah, it was the Isra and Mi'raj. But doing it the same time as the Isra and Mi'raj is accidental. And the 60th anniversary is absolutely accidental. It was just... it all came together.
Well, it's certainly not accidental that your success has political significance in Saudi Arabia.
Let's just say I would have still climbed it even if I was the 100th. I'm not a political person, and it's not in my nature to be preachy at all. But if I can change people's opinion about Arab women, and if I can change Arab women's opinion about themselves, I would love to lend my voice to that. I would love to. Because, you know, growing up in Saudi Arabia, being very sporty and outdoorsy, it was very hard to find a role model that fits my spirit and my personality. We didn't have female sports, Saudi female sports role models. We did not have that. If I'm that person to them now, then yes, I'd love to take that role.
Is it the case that you can climb Mount Everest, but you can't drive down to the mall in your own car?
I've been asked that question, and really it's baffling to me, because of course I believe driving is every human being's right. But mind you, if this is not something we can have now, if for whatever reason, whether I agree or not, the country, the government, or whatever it is not allowing it now, there are so many other aspects and so many other areas that we can excel in and we can work on. People are so focused on the no driving, and they're completely forgetting all the other great things that is just waiting for a Saudi woman to do.
Raho Muharrak is the first Saudi woman to climb and reach the top of Mount Everest. She reached the summit last month on May 18th. At 25 years old, she's not just the first Saudi woman to accomplish this feat, but also the youngest Arab. She joined us from her home in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. I spoke earlier with a very energetic unpaid intern who sued his company, arguing he should have been paid for work he was providing, and he won his lawsuit. We're asking you for your stories of unpaid internships. Have you had one? Was it worth it? Was it fair? Ryan from Miami Beach says the experience was valuable, but probably wouldn't have happened if pay had been required.
My first transition from the service industry to the professional world was an unpaid internship with the Small Business Administration, something that definitely would not have existed due to red tape, had it even paid minimum wage.
Not so positive in this text from Detroit, Michigan. Oh, God, it's modern century slavery. Nothing makes you feel more inadequate than free work. Natalie from South Carolina is excited, though, that she might actually get paid for intern work.
I'm interested in potentially changing careers into teaching at some point. And as a non-traditional student, an unpaid internship, a.k.a. student teaching semester, is not feasible financially for me.
Always want to hear from you. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or join this conversation on our Facebook page, facebook.com/TheTakeaway. Some thoughts now as we head into this Father's Day weekend about dads and fatherhood. There are any number of cliches we might evoke right now, mushy or goofy movie references.
Annie, it's a little nippy out. You might want to put on a sweater.
Dad, it's okay. I'm kind of warm.
So there's a chill in the air, and you've been on a plane.
Dad, I'm fine.
Annie, it is kind of cold out.
It is?
Yeah.
All right, thanks. I'll get my jacket.
I was no longer the man in my little girl's life.
Steve Martin in Father of the Bride there. But we begin with someone as far away from the cliche father as you can get. In the words of his son, Denny Bouchard's father was absent, even crazy. But he is still a magnificent presence in his own life as a man in his late 30s. Denny Bouchard is author of Cures for Hunger and Vandal Love. In many ways, those books are all about Denny's own relationship with his father. And it's why this holiday is a complicated one, full of remembrance and regret. Denny Bouchard, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Did you ever do the Father's Day thing in your odd upbringing?
I don't remember having done it. I must have. My mother must have prodded me at some point and told me I should say Happy Father's Day to my father. But I was pretty young, and I don't really recall having paid much attention to it.
So these days, I gather, you know, Father's Day, if it's not completely irrelevant, is at least about giving your dad a little slack.
It certainly is. And I think that the older I get, the more I realize how similar I am to him and many of the not so good ways, so I cut him increasingly more slack.
Now, why does your dad constitute a character who needs to be cut slack as we think about these sort of folksy, sugary notions of fatherhood and dad worship and here's the tie that I got for you, that sort of thing?
I'd say he deserves to be, he needs to be cut slack because he, in almost every way, wasn't the model father. From the time I understood language, he was telling me how to fight. He was telling me how to fight in some pretty vicious ways. And he basically set out to instill in me a love for all forms of danger from the time I was very young, and in a way that really wouldn't help a child to survive. Some things would help a child to survive. These wouldn't. For example, he would park my brother and me on the railroad track, and he would wait till the train got pretty close, and he'd turn the truck off and pretend it wouldn't start. And as the train got closer and closer to the truck, he'd keep trying to start it and get us to yell at him and say, we'd give him advice, you know, pump the gas, turn the key. And finally the truck would start and he'd pull off the train track just before the train got there. And I really enjoyed these sorts of experiences. This was sort of the adventures, the games we'd play with my father.
Wait a minute. How old were you when you enjoyed these experiences?
I guess I was 5, 6.
But you must have been a little freaked out.
I remember the first time being a little uncertain. But then I quickly saw that, you know, he was laughing. He was having a good time. Why wouldn't I have a good time? And I think any sort of experience where a child feels that he can bond, a boy feels he can bond with his father, ends up becoming a positive experience.
Right.
Sometimes he'd put the keys in his pocket and walk off and leave us in there and then run
on the
back
tracks,
the last minute.
On the tracks?
On the tracks, yeah. And then he'd run back the last minute, start the truck, and pull off. But which was weird because his truck often stalled in traffic, so I always wondered how he knew it was going to start then, but it did.
Well, it's hard to know what the sort of toughening lesson is there, but you can certainly see that he's trying to say on some level he's capable of protecting you.
Yeah, I guess that's one way to look at it. The way I always looked at it was just that he was crazy and trying to give us a taste for adventure and
good
for
call.
Craziness as well.
And he's managed to instill that in you.
He has. You know, I'm now 38, and when I was in my 20s, I always thought I was going to turn out very different from him. And now I realize I've turned out far more like him than I ever expected. And I travel all over the world. I have a pretty large enjoyment for dangerous experiences. And I think that does come from him.
Do you think your dad was cruel on some level, thought of himself as a father who didn't measure up, who just wasn't able to deliver in the end? And in your case, would you do anything differently?
I think that he probably wasn't very aware of the impact of his actions. This is a guy who'd spent more than a decade of his life robbing banks. He'd spent 7 years of his life in federal penitentiary. His entire life he'd been getting in fights, escaping police, doing pretty crazy stuff. And I think at a certain point you lose perspective on what's normal. And I certainly think that he probably didn't have a lot of perspective on the impact of his actions. And, you know, parking some kids on a train track is probably relatively minor after you've, you know, jacked 50 banks. You know, I think that my mother left him when I was 10, and I lived in Virginia for 5 years. And I think that when I saw him again when I was 15, he was rethinking how he'd lived. And I certainly know that if I were a father, I would definitely do things very differently. I know that I was asked to babysit once when I was a teenager, and I put the kids on the hood of the car, my hood of my car, and drove them around a field. So I was very much influenced by that. But I wouldn't do that with my own children or anyone else's children at this point.
Glad to hear it. Yeah. And, you know, we can laugh now, but your dad had a very painful life in the end. I mean, he took his own life, right?
He did. He did. I think, you know, at the end of his life, it was, first of all, you know, to put things in context, this is a guy who had, by the end of his life, he hadn't talked to his family in 30 years. He'd cut himself off from his parents, he had 9 brothers and sisters. He hadn't spoken to them in 30 years. And I think that the very concept of family was something he'd so totally rejected in his youth that by the time he got to be older, he realized, in a sense, how much that was something that needed to be taken care of, that needed to be nurtured, that even the relationships he'd built with his own children were so fragile or unhealthy that he couldn't really communicate what he wanted to communicate at the end of his life. So I think he would have, from that moment when he looked back on his life, I think he would have done things very differently.
So if on this weekend you can have some sense of the importance of Father's Day, that's an extraordinary testimony to what fatherhood actually means.
Fatherhood is an extremely powerful thing, and I can't in any way deny how important he was as a father to me. Even when I was living in Virginia and I hadn't seen him for 5 years, I was obsessed with him. I wanted to go back, find my father. I wanted to rob banks with him when I found out he was a bank robber. The day I found out he'd been a bank robber was one of the happiest days of my life. I remember thinking, this is it. I'm going to write books and rob banks, and my father and I are going to be best friends. We're going to travel the country robbing things. And I think for a young man, you know, we're always looking at our father in a sense as a measure of who we are and what we're allowed to do. And I have to say that his having been a bank robber gave me permission to do whatever I wanted in life. And I was fortunate that I chose to go to university and pursue a career in writing as a result of that, because I could have taken a lot of other paths. But it did give me permission to do pretty much whatever I wanted in life, which I think is a significant permission. It's not one that we receive often.
Hmm. Well, happy Father's Day to you, Denny Bouchard.
Thank you. You too.
Denny Bouchard is the author of Cures for Hunger and Vandal Love. His newest book, Empty Hands, Open Arms, about conservation in the Congo, comes out in October. More on dads tomorrow on the show. Denny Bouchard says the happiest day of his life was learning his dad was a bank robber and he wanted to just run around and rob banks with his dad. Have you ever had anything like that happen to you? What did you discover about your dad, something that was hidden away? We'd love to hear the story. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway or head over to our website, thetakeaway.org. I'm thinking, I've got to have a moment like that with my own dad. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.